Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dosey, founder and host. Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Joachim, CEO and founder of Mina Technologies. Hey, Joachim, great to have you on the show. How's everything going today?
Hey, Richard. So thank you for allowing my participants. It's going good. So stuck in Sweden, the sandbox of the world, but if I didn't read the news, everything would be as usual. So I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Yeah, I hear you. But sounds good anyway. Let's start the show by you telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. So let's try to do 30 years and 30 seconds. So my name is Joachim. I'm one of the three co-founders of Mina. I've been running tech ventures for the past 9 years and spent the past 6 years in fintech. So I have quite a handful of experience of witnessing the banking behavior shifting from what I usually say competition to collaboration. So spending a lot of time just looking at the market, what is happening with the trends, and what's the future of digital banking. Just to put two words on myself, so 9 years as a founder in the tech industry. Before that, I spent 4 years as a snowboard instructor. So it kind of made a big pivot in life, moving into entrepreneurship. With the one red thread is that I like to solve problems. So all of the companies I've been part of starting has been based on my personal consumer experiences. So that's why I'm here today, addressing things that I experienced myself.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And actually, maybe stay on that thread for a sec. You've obviously had an interesting path into sort of entrepreneurship and founding of businesses, and then into the tech, and more recently in the last 6 odd years into the fintech space. But what prompted you to make that pivot from sort of snowboard instructor to into the tech and then obviously into the fintech world?
Well, it's 50 degrees warmer, so if you get to stay inside, that's one benefit. No, but jokes aside, in the end, it were about financial matters. So my first company that I started was working with physical pain recovery. So at the time, I was still working in the Alpine industry. I actually dropped my physical hard drive. So this was back in 2011. You remember, we actually had these big clumps to store your data on. So I basically lost all of my photos and all of my relevant files from my teenage life, and I wanted to restore them. And then I got an offer on just above €1,000 to repair my hard drive. I couldn't afford it, so I learned to do it myself. So that experience of just researching on how do you fix a broken hard drive was the foundation of the first business. Ran that for a couple of years until 2013, when all of the backup went into the cloud. So when Dropbox and Google Cloud and OneDrive and all of those players came to market, I went out of the market. So that was a big learning.
Cool. I mean, it sounds like an interesting start into entrepreneurship, and then obviously tech. You know, if we dive into that a bit more, I mean, you mentioned experiences that you've had. What, you know, in your early, maybe leveraging your snowboard career and looking at your early career in sort of the tech world, what experiences have you had that sort of helped you get to the position you are in your current venture?
So I think all founders do a lot of mistakes in the first and even the second journey they do. So the experiences from the first business is, of course, a crucial success factor for whatever comes next. More on a generic level, I think the, let's say, perspective and the visionary part, the ability to tell a story and a compelling narrative that others like to follow has been a very big enabler. And that goes outside my professional career. That's more of an individual skill set. That one of the crucial pillars that you need to have in the early days is the, let's say, not the opportunity, but the skill set required to convince people to trust in your very early idea. Because as you might very well know, banks are reluctant to risk. Risk is part of their DNA. So how do you get someone to purchase into a vision and a very early day software?
Oh, cool. I mean, it's definitely an acquired skill. And are there any standout, I mean, maybe this is the wrong word, but I'll say it anyway. Are there any standout mistakes that you've obviously gone through this, that you look back now and you go, wow, that's sort of, that's helped me. And that's at least I look back, I have that experience, and it's helped me get to sort of where I am.
It's easy to sell in hindsight, but one of the big mistakes was start selling software to banks in 2013. If you approach the bank in 2013 and say, hey, can I read your data? I want to build a product. They would throw you out of a window. So the attitude to sharing data has obviously changed due to PSD2 and maturity in general, but I was a few years ahead of the breakthrough in trying to collaborate with banks. The doors were not open. Today they are wide open and the red carpet is there.
Oh, cool. And you know, how was the idea of MENA Technologies? How did that come about?
Well, pretty similar to my first business. So this time I did not drop the hard drive into the floor, but I had a couple of awkward experiences related to subscription payments. So one of the things I noticed when I ended my first business, I went to university on a very limited budget after losing some money on the first business and then, of course, taking student loans and similar solutions. So when I realized that this moment was that I've been paying for a video streaming service that I hadn't been using for more than 6 months. So, okay, this is annoying. I pay for subscriptions I don't even use and I'm on a very limited budget. The second thing I experienced that I'm sure that you can relate to was a very cumbersome cancellation experience. So when becoming a student, I was supposed to switch my telco operator to go on a student price plan. The cancellation process to my existing provider was more than an hour long. So standing in the phone line, you get redirected to a save desk or a win-back department trying to convince you to stay. So it takes 1 minute to become a customer and an hour to get out of it. So these two experiences were kind of the fundamental reasons why we started this company, that people are paying for a lot of different subscriptions and they waste a lot of time whenever they need to make a change.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty compelling story and obviously problems to solve. And I assume during the journey over the years, as everything's moved and you know, as the industry's matured and businesses have also matured, your product has evolved. Could you give us a bit of background about the evolution of your business and product over the last few years?
So I think the biggest evolution is in terms of distribution rather than functionality. So the core problem that we're addressing that is known as the subscription economy, that has only grown over the past years. So I would say that the macro trend that we observed back in 2013 is even more visible today. You can see major companies such as Apple running their iPhone renewal program or Volvo, the car manufacturer, trying to sell cars on a subscription basis. So this problem is bigger than before. What has changed is the distribution method. So when we started to build the solution, we were a straight B2C application. So anyone in the country could download our application and we would help you keep track and cancel your subscription services. What we've done now is that we pivoted the company into a B2B2C proposition, integrating these products inside the banks instead of obtaining our own users in our own application. So I usually refer to the omnichannel experience that me as a consumer would like one application to run my finances. I don't want 10 niche applications to help me with, let's say, narrow or deep problems.
And I mean, you know, how has shifting the model helped you guys, you know, progress in your business?
So from a business model perspective, we do sell all of our products as a SaaS business model to banks today. So just enabling that license part of the business is a crucial part. If you look at a lot of the B2C fintechs, and I'm not going to name them, but there are horrible examples of companies that are growing fast, but their P&Ls and their, let's say, balance sheets are taking a big hit. So if you have a licensed core revenue part, that will allow you to stay in business for a lot longer without raising those hundreds of millions in venture capital. Second one is, of course, customer adoption or customer acquisition, rather. So with the partnerships that we have today, currently across 6 markets in Europe, we reach more than 18.7 million users. And if you want to do that acquisition as a B2C company, well, that's expensive. And then you have the third one, which is all about the behavior. So the consumers have easier access to the service now compared to when we were a standalone application. So easy access, license revenue, and customer acquisition are all addressed by selling it through banks rather than direct to consumer.
Yeah, that sort of makes a complete sense. Just taking a couple of steps back, at the beginning of the show, you mentioned being able to tell stories, get people and getting people, clients, people, etc., understanding your vision and sort of buying into it. So in the early days, what tactics did you use to create that sort of product awareness and how has this evolved over the years?
Oh, I remember a day when we raised our seed round of 1.6 million euros, and we actually got Swedbank to take that investment. So they became our first B2B customer, but also our investor. And at this moment in time, I got the opportunity to talk for part of their senior management. And I told them you need to stop paying dividends and you need to reinvest everything you have into innovation. So this was, of course, a bit naive, and I was 24 years old back then. However, I do think that the banks can choose if they want to have the stock valuation like Tesla or like Ford. So the competition is changing and innovation holds a value in itself. if you don't reinvest right now, you will be obsolete in 5 years from now. So I think this provocative tone, telling them about the future and your competition is no longer Barclays versus Lloyds or Swedbank against Nordea or Commerzbank against Deutsche Bank. The new competition are the Monzos, the Revolus, and the N26 of the world, and also the big techs. We can see Facebook and Google and Apple all going into finances. So banks need to stop fighting each other, collaborate to deliver the next generation of digital value, or you will churn your customers a few years from now. So this provocative story was provocative, and I started. Today is very much the reality.
Interesting. And you know, before maybe take a look at your product and maybe the process or framework that, other than storytelling, the process or framework that you use to make certain that, you know, you did have a product and market fit and you were able to get to that table. Were there steps involved? Was there research involved? Was there, you know, alignment with industry bodies involved? What exactly did you guys do to get to, you know, obviously that seed round and the success that's followed on?
So a very big enabler was the fact that we did run a B2C business before. So we launched our first B2C application in 2016, and we pretty rapidly became the second most adopted fintech in the Nordics after Tink. So with this track record, the need for the product and the problem we solved was, let's say, evidence enough for the bank to take the risk. So in the end, the partnership that we had with Swedbank was actually them asking us that the functionality that you have developed, could we integrate this inside our mobile bank? So hitting that kind of product fit with the end user was a crucial piece to the success of why the bank chose to buy this product. And when scaling outside of Sweden, I think we always need to bring the evidence that the need for this product does exist in your market. So being proactive through acceleration programs and market research and industry bodies, as you said, the consultancy firms, to have enough meat on your bones that this is a real problem for you as a bank and for your end user.
Interesting point you mentioned there. You mentioned scaling into different geographies, different markets. Do you think your product will have to slightly adapt as you enter these new sort of markets or geographies?
So I think slightly is the key word here. So if you look at the cancellation product, that we help consumers to cancel subscriptions with a click of a button, that reality exists across the globe. That is always appreciated, so we don't need to interact too much on that. Just to put a number, we conducted more than 300,000 successful cancellations, so we saved our users more than 60 million euros. But on the other topic, so we also deliver a product we call Improve. So we make sure that you are on a good price plan for your energy contract or for a telco contract, very similar to Compare the Market or Uswitch or GoCompare, you know, those players. In order to deliver that functionality into a new market, you need to understand what kind of behavior does exist. So in the UK, it's very common to switch energy provider. But if you want to launch in France, maybe you should start with telco or broadband or any other kind of service. So it's more of a priority and behavior rather than a product.
Yeah, no, got it. And what tactics are you using and have you used to actually reach out to your ideal customers? I know you've mentioned sort of partnerships, but are there any other tactics, digital or other, that you're using?
Yeah, indeed. So we are utilizing a framework known as Megadeals. It's a pretty new framework. It was launched in 2019 by a couple of Swedish authors. But the theory is based on more than 130 different companies that performed so-called mega deals, selling software in the excess of $15 million. And there are a few common factors that they conclude in the research. So we are focusing on a very few accounts in our sales pipe. We always make sure that there is an existing key initiative that we deliver towards. So if the bank have the ambition to monetize their user base, then we have one product proposition. If they have the key initiative to reduce their cost of operation, well, there will be a different product scope. Another important piece of the pillar is, of course, consensus. So we go into very few target organizations, but we do it very widely. So selling into an organization with 20,000 employees can't be a hit and miss. You need to know who should you talk to at what time. So spending a significant amount of time in these 12, 18, 24-month sales processes, you need to get the deal done or you wasted 2 years of your runway. So there are a few more pillars. So I can just recommend the Mega Deals framework for you to read up on.
And what about social media? Do you guys look at, I know it's a big corporate that you are looking at, but what about LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, all these channels? Have you explored or are you using them as part of reaching out to your ideal customers?
Oh, we are using them quite a lot. So account-based marketing is also a crucial part of this selling framework. So understanding the different levels of stakeholders, so you can't do some form of C-suite marketing, you will get no effect. They don't have any P&L accountability in the end. So yes, of course, we expose our products through mainly LinkedIn to get these stakeholders wrapped up and exposed to the value proposition. So independent messaging to each account, depending on the key initiative that they do have.
Yeah. Targeted messaging makes total sense. You know, obviously we're in the midst of a global pandemic and what have you. What challenges have you faced with respects to continuing to build or optimize your sales pipeline over the past few months?
Well, I think it goes back to risk. So risk is part of the DNA with our customer base. All of the banks are very risk averse. So we have seen examples of mature deals that have slipped in terms of timing. So we can see banks in Spain and even banks in the UK that have a hard vendor block that during the pandemic, we're not going to procure any new vendors. On the other side, we do have products that are enabling self-service. So the customer can actually reduce their back office volumes if they integrate our products. So for such a use case, it's actually more important now than ever. So we can look at some of the UK examples where they shared information that their back office volumes increased with 400% when they closed the branches. If you have a product to reduce their back office workload, well, you're in a very good spot right now.
Yeah, makes total sense. And I guess as you go forward and we move out of where we are right now globally and also obviously Europe and the Nordics, etc., what are you guys looking to do over the next sort of 6 to 12 months? How are you looking to grow and how are you going to achieve this?
One thing that we haven't touched upon yet was that we obtained Visa as an investor in our Series A that we closed early 2019. And having Visa as a strategic partner at this phase of a company has proven to be very valuable. So there are thousands of banks across the globe. A majority of them are already Visa clients. So utilizing that existing network to get the reach first, of course, first and foremost in Europe, since PSD2 and open banking is a mature behavior. But of course, by end of 2021, we will be looking at enabling subscription management products across the globe rather than to Europe. And there are a few criteria that need to be checked in this. So if you look at North America or Australia, there are a couple of years behind Europe in terms of PSD2 and open banking mentality. But I think the doors would open up to go outside of Europe. That's a big one.
Awesome. Congratulations on the Visa partnership. That's great news. And, you know, some of our listeners are obviously going through a process of optimizing their sales pipeline or building their sales pipeline. What's the biggest tip you can give them in order to, you know, get those clients, create awareness, get those clients in the pipeline and get selling?
So let's talk about applying a T-shaped sales funnel. So even if you have a big list of potential leads that you would like to collaborate with, the majority of them are not good for you right now. So there might be budgetary issues, there might be other key initiatives that they are serving. So if you're trying to collaborate with a bank that recently had an AML scandal or KYC issues, you know that their funding and their focus will be on their internal struggles rather than buying new third-party software. So make sure to fail fast and disqualify the potential accounts that you will not secure in the foreseeable 18 to 24 months. I would also emphasize the value of having that marketing and staying top of mind. So even if you hire 5, 10, or 15 new account executives trying to run the market for you, the process is what it is. So you can double your sales force, but you will not shorten the sales cycle. So make sure that you have a very high success rate on those few accounts where you invest your resources. And that being said, make sure you're spending your money wisely because you will not realize revenue from any account in the foreseeable 18 to 24 months. So first you need to close the deal, you get into the next budgetary cycle, then you do the technical integration, and while it's live, well, you start to realize revenue. But how do you pay salaries for another 2 years before you see the money?
Those are really good points. And just to touch on one there, maybe your first point, fail fast. And also, you know, make certain the people that you get onto your calls are and you spend your time with are qualified, as you mentioned. You want them to be the guys and the girls that actually want to spend the money with you or spend time with you.
It sounds basic, but you really need to go forensic on this. Just one or two accounts that should be disqualified, but you choose to proceed with them. Well, that's the full attention of one or two FTEs that could have brought you another 2 million ARR into your cash flow.
Yeah, laser focused. I mean, is that, I mean, I guess you guys are very much, you know, following that model. And how's that focus help drive not only obviously sales, but also you touched on it, operational efficiency?
So when you're running a B2B2C model, it's a bit of a complex situation because you have a B in the middle that is your actual customer. So we're selling the software to the bank, but we're solving the majority of the problems for the end user. So in terms of operational efficiency, should we invest in product development to have a better offering for the end user? Or should we invest in product development that will make the bank more happy? So when you have two stakeholders as your buying party, so to speak, or the one you're serving, how do you distribute your resources? I don't have a firm answer to it, but there needs to be a balance. And of course, it's a perfect case for venture. I think all of the B2B2C fintechs are building a product, delivering it to banks with all the compliance necessary. It will be cash flow negative for a few years ahead. But once you have delivered a working product to a bank, you can expect that account to stay for several years. So perseverance.
Yeah, that's it. Go all in, as some of my previous guests have mentioned. So listen, I mean, really appreciated and really had a great time talking with you today. Before we log off and before we wrap up, how can people find and connect with you and your business?
Well, I try to be as easily accessible as possible as part of my job. So if you want to go LinkedIn, my very Swedish name would be Joakim Kavlum. Feel free to post a link in the description. Otherwise, I'm in email. So it's joakim@minna.tech.
Oh, awesome. Thanks again for joining the show, Joakim, today. And really look forward to watching your business go from strength to strength over the years and seeing what you guys do with the new Visa partnership. Congrats.
There will be something to see a couple of months from now. So come October, I'm sure you will see us.
Sounds good, mate. Speak soon.
Speak soon, Richard. Thank you.